This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of the greatest soul and rhythm and blues recordings wouldn't have been made if it weren't for Jerry Wexler. Wexler died Friday at the age of 91. He was a partner in Atlantic Records from the early 1950s through the mid-70s. His specialty was finding great singers and matching them with the right band and backup singers to create a sound that was both artistically true and commercially successful. The short list of people he worked with includes the Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Etta James, and Solomon Burke. Here's just a few of the records we have Jerry Wexler to thank for.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. When there's no one else around.
Under the
out of the sun,
under the boardwalk,
we'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking about.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be making love.
Under the boardwalk,
boardwalk.
I spoke with Jerry Wexler in 1993, after the publication of his memoir, Rhythm and the Blues. It was a live interview at the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C., in front of an audience of public radio program directors, managers, and producers.
I want to get started with your work with Aretha Franklin. I think that's a good place to start. Now, she had made about, 10 or so recordings on Columbia Records before coming to Atlantic. John Hammond produced her, and he was producing her like a jazz singer, kind of in the Dinah Washington tradition. Yeah. You, when she came to Atlantic, you worked with her. You heard something completely different. What did you hear when you started producing her?
Well, I heard the Aretha Franklin who sang in church, who sang Precious Lord when she was 13 years old, and a man in the audience was so overcome, he said, listen at her, listen at her. And I listened, and it wasn't so much that I tried a new approach to her. It's that what she did fit very well in with what we were doing anyhow.
Well, you sat her down at the piano. You
right.
had her play herself, which I don't think she'd done on the records before that.
Not very much.
What was it like at Muscle Shoals? What did you hear there in that southern sound that you wanted?
Well, it was the way they recorded, which was ad-lib recording without written arrangements, building the song from the get-go, just from the chords, and the musicians made a fabulous contribution. So these were arrangements which we all did together, and they were just as much arrangements as anything that was ever done by Henry Mancini, in the sense of being an arranged piece of music.
So you took Aretha down to Muscle Shoals, recorded like a track and a half with her, and there was this really big fight. What was the fight about?
There was an explosion that went on because of too much Jack Daniels and not enough Prudence. And it had to do with Ted White, who was Aretha's husband at the time, who got it into a dangerous, over-friendly drinking from the same jug with a gentleman who can best be described as a card-carrying redneck, trumpet player. And it got into what we called the dozens, the southern dozens, and then it got nasty. And the session blew up, and we went back to New York with one song complete, which was I Never Loved a Man, and a three-piece track on the other side, which was Do Right Woman. And all we had there was rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, which is not a whole lot to go on.
Not even vocal?
No vocal. No piano. no background vocal. And then we finished by bringing Aretha and her sisters into the studio. And it was a pretty good piece of extemporization in that, starting with this very minimal track, Aretha laid down an organ part and a piano part. And then she sang the lead, and then she and her sisters got together and did the background. And it was a very full, finished record put together, I'd say, with spit and chewing gum.
You produced Respect. Is there a story behind how the Sakatumis landed on there?
Well, the story is that when Otis Redding did it, it was entirely a different song. The Sakatumis were Aretha Franklin's idea, where she injected into the song, which connoted a certain idea of social respect, probably the notion of ethnic respect, combined with a little judicious lubricity on her part. The respect that she was talking about was what you might call, very bluntly call, proper sexual attention. But it was her transmutation of Otis Redding's little Southern song. As a matter of fact, I was mixing the record in our studio on Broadway, and Otis walked in. He said, "That little gal done took my song."
Now, your first studio was actually the office.
That's right.
Of Atlantic Records. Who did you? Because when Atlantic was young, you didn't have a studio. So what'd you do? You'd move out the chairs into the hallway whenever you want to record?
We did have a studio. It was our office, and it was a studio because we had equipment in it. And my partner, Ahmed Erdogan, and I shared this big room. We had two desks that were catty-cornered, canted toward each other. And what we would do is push them against the wall, stack them, and then our engineer, Tom Dowd, would set out camp chairs, a few microphones, and one mic in the hall for echo.
Now, you work with Otis Redding a lot during his career.
I was not Otis's producer. I want you to realize that. Otis was produced at Stax Records in Memphis by that great team of Jim Stewart and Booker T and the MGs, especially Steve Cropper.
Now, you saw him change a lot as he became better
known.
What was he like in the beginning before he was very famous? What was he
Otis
like on stage?
Otis was very simple, very unaffected, but he had the magic. And when he came to New York after his first hit record, I picked him up at the airport. No roadies, nobody, no nothing, just the soul Otis. And he opened at the Apollo, and he just stood there, just straight on, with his arms at his side, didn't move. Another one who started like that was Marvin Gaye. But they learned some stagecraft, but what really kicked Otis into moving was having to follow Sam and Dave, who used to be described as a stage full of Jackie Wilsons.
That's really great. No, you know, we were talking before how you brought Aretha Franklin down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You brought Wilson Pickett down to Memphis to record.
Right.
You really loved that Southern sound that was coming out of some of the bands there. Why'd you think of bringing him there?
Well, because everything was winding down in New York. I mean, it was entropy. We just couldn't get out of our own way. We had been very successful year after year. But our style of recording was a regular old-time standard style, using arrangers with written arrangements. Now, when you have to change an arrangement, and you almost always do, to accommodate the vicissitudes of the song and where you're going, it's total agony for the entrepreneur to see that clock going around while a man is going around with an eraser, erasing little notes on 13 charts. And this Southern style of recording, where it's just all you have is chord indications. You go out, you sing a lick, do it like this, fellas. Bang, here's the new chord, you know. But maybe that's overstating it, but actually there's a spontaneity and a fantastic new element that comes in because the musicians are organic to the idea.
We're listening back to a 1993 interview with Jerry Wexler. He died Friday at the age of 91. Here's a Wilson Pickett track that Wexler produced in 1966.
If you need
We'll hear more of our 1993 interview with record producer Jerry Wexler after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1993 interview with Jerry Wexler. He produced many great R&B records for Atlantic Records by Ray Charles, The Drifters, Wilson Pickett, Solomon Burke, and Aretha Franklin. Wexler died Friday at the age of 91.
There's so much that a record producer is up against, often the real unexpected, and I think a great example of that is when you were producing the Drifters' version of Under the Boardwalk. Let's start with the beginning of that story. First of all, they didn't want to even record the song.
That's right.
You gave them an ultimatum.
Right. I was not the line producer of that song. I was acting as a supervisor, you know, as an executive of the company, and the Drifters were always a concern of mine. And a great producer, deceased Bert Burns, was producing the record, and neither he nor any of the Drifters could stand the song. They just couldn't buy it. And I didn't want to interfere because Bert was the producer, but this sounds like a very self-congratulatory. And I said, this song has to be done. And I said, you can pick all the rest. I said, or else ain't no session.
Why'd you like the song so much?
Because it sounded like a hit.
Okay, good enough reason. Okay, so what happened to the lead singer the night before the session?
The lead singer at the time was a man named Rudy Lewis. You know, we had three fantastic lead singers in the Drifters. The first was Clyde McFadder. The second was Rudy Lewis. His name is not as well known, but he did some great songs. And the third was Benny King, who's having a great resurgence with Stand By Me. I mean, you can't turn around without hearing it anymore. But Rudy Lewis, unfortunately, the night before the session, was found dead in the hotel room with a hypodermic needle in his arm. And the night before the session. And we tried to call off the session, but it was a big date, and we had hired a lot of union musicians, and the union wasn't cutting us any slack at all. They gave us 24 hours. So we moved the session ahead one more day, but then we couldn't even change the charts. So we had to use Johnny Moore to sing the lead, and without even the key change, and he managed to sing it in the key that was put to him. And the interesting thing about the record was we promoted it all along the Eastern Seaboard and Atlantic City and so on, and it evokes summer all the time.
And you actually did a lot of that yourself, didn't you? You packed up the car and drove around promoting the record
because
you wanted it to break so bad.
That's right, and we did a lot of that in those days.
I really want you to talk a little bit about the early days of getting black music played on white radio stations, and you were doing promotion as well as production at Atlantic Records back in the 50s and the early 60s when radio was still pretty segregated. And I'd like to hear a little bit about what it was like to get white DJs to play the rhythm and blues recordings that you were producing then.
Heavy agita. You just couldn't do it. I mean, you couldn't, except for white disc jockeys on black stations. This was an odd phenomenon. The leading disc jockeys on rhythm and blues stations were Caucasians who, without being mimetic, they managed to sound black, and the audiences accepted them as black. I'm talking about people like Zena Sears from New Jersey, Hunter Hancock from L.A., Huggy Boy from L.A., of course, Alan Freed, who came along and of course, he got so big that he couldn't disguise his racial identity anymore. So it was very difficult. And this was not due to racist attitudes on the part of the PDs or the musical directors. It had to do with the advertisers. This black music did not fit with the demographics. It was simple as that. So it was no use ranting and raving. It was part of the socioeconomics of the era. The music, it would be like playing mazurkas, you know, on a classical station. It just didn't go.
Back in those days, too, to get a record played, you had to pay for it, more or less.
Oh, yeah.
To pay for consideration, as you put it.
Absolutely. It was a subterranean advertising, let's say. These people were badly underpaid. Of course, I'm sure I'm sure that's changed a lot. And the guy... And the guy at the mic is just rolling in the fantastic emoluments.
So what were some of the things you would do for the disc jockeys?
An Orlon sweater, bottle of Jim Beam, until it got real competitive, and then we got into the hundreds per month.
Right.
Yeah. Another thing is that what you would do is that you'd bring your artist there, and he could have a stage show or a concert and be the entrepreneur, and he'd get them for a very low price, like zilch, sometimes nothing. And so you paid your dues to get these, and we were glad to do it.
One of the great things about this book is that there's all kinds of like fights between legendary people that are out. There's a when you got the call that Aretha Franklin was ready to sign with Atlantic Records, there was a wonderful fight.
All right.
Happening in the studio between Wilson Pickett and was it Percy Sledge?
Percy Sledge. Percy Sledge is also a native of Muscle Shoals. He came from Alabama, and very genial, sweet man. And I was working on a vocal with Wilson Pickett, and Percy comes into the control room, and he said, "Wilson, that was great, man. You sound just like Otis." I mean, the red neck came up, you know, and Wilson bristled, and I got Percy out, and I said, "Percy, later." Well, he comes ambling back in about 3 hours later. He said, "Man, that was a hell of a lick. That was just like James." That's the worst thing he could have said, because James Brown and Wilson Pickett have had a century-old falling out about a chick, you know? And he couldn't have done worse. And Wilson went for Percy like that. I got in the way, and I probably went about 180 pounds, and he just flicked me like that, and I went to the wall. Because I used to call Wilson the Black Panther before there was a Black Panther movement, because he was, I mean, there was, to me, the ideal metaphor for Wilson, because he was sleek, he was beautiful, and he was like a baling wire and nuts and bolts, and he was terrific. Just a beautiful man, but a man who had definite ideas about his own whims.
So you got the call from Aretha in the middle of this fight,
in the middle
after
of that,
you were slammed against the wall?
Yeah, I bounced off okay, and I got a call from a woman named Louise Bishop, who is still, I think, pretty well known in Philadelphia, working under the name of Louise Williams, gospel disc jockey, a friend of mine. And in those days, Aretha's circle was the gospel wheel. That's right. Who she hung out with. This was before, you know, the big secular explosion. And Louise was a pal of hers. And Louise, a pal of mine, had sort of been hawking her on my account. And she said, "Here's the number. Aretha's ready." And like the fella said, you never look back, you know.
Jerry Wexler recorded in front of a live audience at the Public Radio Conference in 1993. Wexler died Friday at the age of 91.